In today's episode, we get to spend time with the awesome Mac Lackey. Mac is up there with the best of the best. Starting, scaling, and then exiting a business is one of the hardest things you can do. And he had 2 8-figure exits by the time he was 30. He then made some really clear life choices to prioritize his family and went on to have another 4 successful exits after having his daughters. I've heard Mac speak many times and I'm constantly impressed by how he communicates complex ideas in super simple and highly compelling language. In today's episode, we cover starting and scaling businesses, building networks, how do you build a business and also ensure you're a present parent, how much does sport align to business and building resilience in kids as well as adults, as well as finding the right words to unlock amazing opportunities. Prepare to be blown away by his insights and practical advice in an inspiring conversation that is truly heartwarming. I wanted to share the story of when I first met Mac, and we were doing our Scale Up Scotland programme, and we knew that we had an online session that day, and we'd done lots of the sessions, had been in person, and this was the first time we'd done a virtual session. So I was a little like, how's this going to work? And I wasn't quite sure how the format would go. And Mac had a group of 20 entrepreneurs absolutely spellbound for an hour with amazing insights and content from growing businesses to leadership to exiting to sports and everything in between. And I think that's a really hard thing to do, actually. So, yeah, thank you for that experience and for all the insights from that session and sharing it with us today.
Well, I was very jealous that you were in a Scottish castle and I was online. So I hopefully next time I will actually be in person.
Definitely. And yeah, it's a very cool thing to be part of. So yeah, I think the insights that we got from that day, there's been so much that stuck. And I think I've done lots of different like learning things and heard different people speak. And sometimes you just hear someone and it really clicks. So I was excited to have that conversation today and get to share some of these insights with our audience. So Mac, I wanted to start with a bit of an intro to who you are, and I thought you're best to do that. So give us a quick intro, as you do wear lots of hats.
So I guess the way I think about my life is kind of in two pretty big buckets, you know, as a child all the way through kind of getting started in my business career. My focus was on what we in the United States call soccer. The rest of the world calls football. I was kind of a passionate player and fan of the game, and all of my goals and dreams as a kid were related to that. I'm always happy to talk about that, but that shaped a lot of my early life. And then I started my first business in the first quarter of 1995, right after Netscape launched the commercial web browser. I launched my first internet company. And so I sort of fell in love with early stage, high growth companies. I was incredibly fortunate to have some success with that business. And it just really set me on this path. So the very kind of high level description, you know, at this point, I've started, scaled up and exited 6 companies. That's kind of the highlight reel along the way. I made a million mistakes and I'm always happy to talk about those, but yeah, most of my sort of experience was based on, building companies I was passionate about and choosing to exit them at some point in the future.
Thanks. And that first business that you started, going back to 1995, did you have an ambition to exit that business? Did that word even mean anything to you in those early days? Was that something that was top of mind?
No, it's a good question. Honestly, it really wasn't on my radar. You know, I started my first business for 2 primary reasons. One, I had this very brief tenure working for another company, and very quickly I became frustrated that the president of that company, wasn't valuing my input. I was a naive, probably overly arrogant, you know, kid. And I thought I didn't understand why they didn't want my ideas and things. And so I realized very early I was going to have to do my own thing. And so I convinced an engineer in that business to leave with me to start our first company. So kind of out of frustration and desire to prove myself, that was kind of part of the motivation. But the other thing is, we really believed that the internet was going to change everything. And It seems so obvious to say that at this point, but in 1995, my mentor and a lot of smart people, Fortune 500 company CEOs that lived in my city were all saying, you know, the internet was a fad and nobody would ever put a credit card on the internet. And so I had all this sort of wind at my face in terms of what I was choosing to do. But, you know, we were very convicted. We believed in it. And so we just started a business because we wanted to prove ourselves. There was no really goal or ambition other than we wanted to be successful. We wanted to prove ourselves. And then, you know, fast forward kind of 3 years later, we were still like my now wife, my at the time, I think fiance and I were eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches like four nights a week because I was making no money. But we had built a really valuable business. And all of a sudden, the outside world realized that lots of people came kind of knocking and interested in buying what we had built. So it was an eye opener for me. And, you know, I had my first eight figure exit in my mid 20s. And it was life changing on so many levels. But it literally went from peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and not making money to an eight figure exit like that. So that's kind of how it happened. It was really an eye opener.
Yeah. And did you have a feeling like this can't be real when that was all happening? Like, how did you feel emotionally throughout that journey?
I think there was a big part of us that believed we were, you know, we were right about our early convictions. We were proving ourselves out. We were working with Fortune 50 companies and helping them build their first internet sites and software platforms. And so we knew we were kind of onto something. But to realize that same value that we were seeing was worth, you know, $10 million or more to someone was shocking. Yeah. And so that was probably the biggest shock to me, is that we had created that much value in such a short period of time.
Yeah. And it's incredible validation, you know, for all of those years of work and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and awful bosses that kind of cause you to start some of these businesses. And I think I hear that a lot from entrepreneurs, that sometimes you start stuff because other people tell you that's not going to work. And I know that's an experience we had early on. People are like, you know, it's really hard to do that. And when we went to London, oh, so many businesses will fail in London, and going to the US, oh, you won't succeed in the US. Like, there's just this belief and bias that people have that really only spurs you on actually when you're in those situations. So yeah, congratulations on that. It's a brilliant story. And then what happened next? What was the one after that then? Tell me, how did you go from that exit and what happened to then thinking, okay, I'm ready to go again?
So it was really interesting how quickly my kind of mind shifted. And I think it's one of the things I'm really passionate about now is realizing that value can be created so quickly that if you find the right buyers or people that are interested in what you've created, you know, it can be monetized in a very meaningful way. So I went from kind of thinking about how do I pay my bills? How do I, you know, eat something other than peanut butter and jelly, to kind of checking off my lifetime financial goals. I didn't grow up with money. And so all of a sudden I bought a beach house and a sports car and everything I could sort of dream of. And, but starting my next business was really about passion, because I sort of had checked the box of I'd made money. So I actually started a business that was really at the center of my personal passion, which was soccer and this new emerging technology field. And so we started kind of a technology media platform right after the company that I sold was into a roll-up that went public. The day after the IPO, I resigned and I started my next business. And it was really to pursue something I was personally just really passionate about. And so that was my, I guess, first experience in saying, I'm not pursuing something because it's a trend. I'm pursuing it because I am personally just really excited to build it and to benefit from what we create. So that was just an amazing experience too, because a little bit of the sign of the times, but we started that company, started it, scaled it to one of the, like, probably the largest producer of non-televised soccer content in the world in about 14 months, and sold it to a public company in Europe 14 months later. I mean, it was just so fast. The experience there really showed me, you know, where are the levers in terms of how do you create something that grows really quickly? How do you create value very quickly? And then again, finding that right buyer that that really appreciated what we had built. So another, you know, eight-figure exit. I hadn't turned 30 yet, and I had sort of experienced these two outlier events in my life that really shaped everything that kind of happened thereafter.
Yeah. Wow. And the what I've learned from listening to you speak and what you've kind of learned along the way is identifying those strategic buyers. And sometimes it's not always who you think it's going to be. And can you talk a little bit to building those networks really early on? Because I don't think it's something that a lot of business owners are necessarily thinking about. They're, you know, working with clients and they're really authentically running their business and doing the best for their team, but maybe aren't thinking a little bit bigger in terms of strategic relationships and building those like way before you're even thinking about an exit. Is that something you did earlier or is that something that came later? And maybe speaking a little bit to that network building.
Yeah, such a good question. I think, you know, you have this sort of hindsight bias when you look back over a long period of time and you feel like you identified things and you were really insightful. You know, I know I was very fortunate and lucky in plenty of ways. Timing was great. But I think one of the things that we identified pretty early and got right is that the groups that would be interested in what we were building, whether it was potential buyers or potential investors or strategic partners, in my mind, they were all the same. I didn't really have this thought of like, I'm going to identify who's going to buy my company as much as who in the world either values or needs what we're creating. And if we can find those companies and we can talk to them, they're going to be interesting conversations. Maybe they're going to want to invest. Maybe they're going to want to partner with us or help us. Maybe they want to buy us. And so I think what really was happening at a pretty early phase is we were identifying the value or power of networks and really identifying that you want to start building those relationships before you need them. I learned that 10 times over my career, both in terms of raising money, talking to banks, selling your business. When you need someone to invest in your business or need a bank to give you a loan is the worst time to talk to a bank. It's the worst time to talk to a prospective buyer. So we, you know, started talking to groups that we had this theory or thesis, they're going to matter in the future. And if we start talking to them now and we build a relationship now, we show them what we're doing now, and there's really no strings attached, we had this view that it was going to be meaningful in the future. And that's what really happened again and again for me. So I am a huge believer in identifying those strategic partners, those potentially interesting parties years in advance, building relationships with them well before you ever need to make the phone call to say you need money, you want to sell, you'd like to partner, because it's a very different conversation once you've already built the relationship. So yeah, that's the way I sort of thought about it. Now I'm incredibly focused and strategic about it. Like no question. I identify prospective buyers of businesses years in advance. That is a strategy I use and I recommend for others. But at the earliest phase, I think it was just identifying people that we thought could be important in the future.
Yeah. And I think you have some really helpful language around that, because I think when you're building those relationships, you maybe don't even know where to start. But I've heard you say things like, I really admire what you guys are doing in the market, and I just want to have a coffee and have a conversation, and I feel like there's an alliance somewhere down the road and I don't know what it is yet, but I want to kind of learn what you guys are doing in the market. And I think that's a really nice segue into building a relationship where there's not really a transactional purpose at that stage. Like, what are we actually doing? And it helps you maybe figure out a path together. And yeah, I think that network effect is just huge as the years go on. It's not something that happens quickly. It's decades sometimes in the making.
Well, no, you're exactly right. And the other thing that tends to happen is in a active relationship with someone, or even if you're passively tracking a company that you think might be a future partner, you're just reading their press releases, you're reading their, you know, what they're saying in the media, they tend to telegraph their vision and their goals and their plan. And you as an entrepreneur or founder, all you really need is one little nugget, you know, one hook where they say, we are interested in doing something. In the back of your mind, you're thinking to yourself, I could help them with that. And so a lot of great acquisitions, and certainly some of mine that I feel were, you know, worked out really well, is when we identified someone was looking for something. You know, when I sold my second business, it was to an international buyer. They were outside the US, they were based in the UK, they were publicly traded, but we heard that they were looking to get more technology innovation. They were more traditional media, so they wanted more technical innovation. We had that. We also knew they wanted a flag in the ground in the United States. We had that. So all we needed to hear was, we solve two really big problems for this company to have a meaningful reason that we should be in conversation, whether it led to investment or partnership or you know, ultimately selling the business, was a lot less relevant. It was, we solve two really big problems for them just because we had done a little bit of research, and that's all it takes. And so I'm such a huge advocate of just start researching these people, get to know them, and they will tell you where they're trying to go. And if you find that alignment or that intersection, it's pretty powerful. So that's the way I always think about it.
And I feel now there are so many tools that can help us do that in a really quick way. So you've got companies with their, you know, public shareholder report that's out there. And something I did recently was testing a couple of partnerships. I thought, okay, we'll take this shareholder report, we'll take our strategy, like, where does it intersect? Where are the gaps? Where can we find ways to work together? And that is research that would have taken, like, you know, just so much time to do that. And you can't really scale it, whereas it quickly sifts through some of the information that's out there publicly. I think you marry that up with the relational stuff, and you've got a really compelling network, you know, to kind of work with. You mentioned you knew who some of the buyers potentially would be before you maybe even launched the company or in the very early stages. How did you identify those people? Did you have strategies to do that? Was it network? Like, how did you figure out what that actually was?
I think that the simplest way to do that or to think about it is, when you're building a business, you as an entrepreneur, as a founder, you have a vision of what you're going to build. And if you kind of just roll the tape forward and imagine you're starting to achieve those things, you've created the product that you've visioned, you've created the offering, it's creating demand in the market. If you just kind of roll the tape forward and put yourself in that space and ask the question, who is going to care about this now that I've done it? Again, you're 3 years in the future, potentially. And what I try to do is just brainstorm. And I'd like to have, in a perfect world, I always tell my Exit DNA, you know, members, you want 3 to 5 different industries full of buyers. And so imagine and come up with a theory. You don't have to know that they want to buy your business. You just have to have a theory or a thesis on why they should be interested in buying what you've created. And the more you do that exercise, it's kind of like, you know, expanding that mental muscle of, I need to be creative about the future. When I achieve the things that I'm trying to do, who's going to be interested in that? And some of the obvious things are, you know, again, back to my exits. In some cases, it was as simple as, I happen to be in the US and somebody wants a US company. It can be that simple. It can be geography. It could be a service company really is telling the market that they need to productize what they're doing, and you have a product. So the more you can start to just brainstorm and think creatively about who's going to be interested in what you're building, the more you become good at that, and you start tracking them, as we discussed, you start listening to them, what they're saying, or get to know them. And then all it takes is that little point of intersection. You know, that's happened to me so many times that I can, you know, very strongly say it is no longer luck. You know, it just happens. Like, that is a strategic way to create value. And, you know, I sold one of my businesses a little bit later, business, which was apparel related, not a tech business. We knew we were building something valuable, but one of the things I learned is that people within your own industry, larger versions of what you're building, are not often the best buyers. You know, they're probably going to be interested in what you've created, but they don't tend to pay the biggest premiums. The biggest premiums almost always happen when someone outside the market you're in is trying to break in. And so in our case, we talked to all of our competitors. You know, we were competing with the North Face and Patagonia and Columbia, these big outdoor brands, and we were doing very well against them in about 1,000 retail outlets in the U.S. And they were all interested, but we ultimately found out that there was a company that was in basically guns and ammo. This is a very, you know, U.S. thing, of course, but, and they had a huge image problem because guns and ammo are very polarizing. They needed to buy something in the outdoor industry to diversify, to kind of shift the PR message. And we found out that they needed to do that. We had a national brand, and we found out the chairman of the company actually wore our product. It just lined up perfectly. So all of a sudden, we have this perfect buyer outside our industry that needs to be in the space that we're in. So we sort of answer the question, how do they enter the space that we're in? So that's happened to me so often that it's just become part of my playbook, and certainly something I recommend for any other entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And looking out with your space into those strategic buyers is just going to create so much more value for the business. And I guess that moves me on to when you're building that value for the business. And I've heard you speak about use their math, like don't use your math because, you know, you've got a much smaller kind of pool, and use the influence that you can actually deliver for that buyer. How much of it do you think comes down to pure numbers and finances versus more strategy and to an extent relationships? Like, where do you see that split off? Because I feel like I hear big mixes. It'd be interesting to get your take on that.
I'm probably relatively extreme, and I think a lot of people would disagree with me. But to me, financials, the numbers are a really, really small part of it. You know, the reality is, your revenue, your EBITDA, your market share, all those numbers are a signal to the market. You know, if your revenue is strong and growing, that's a good signal. If your EBITDA is high, it shows that you're, you know, running a good business. But there's something core to your business that is the actual reason that your revenue is growing and that your EBITDA is at a certain level. And that's what ultimately matters. Now, the reason it confuses so many entrepreneurs is when you go to market or you're talking to investors or you talk to investment bankers, 90% of them will immediately go to, tell me about your last 12 months. Tell me about last quarter. Tell me your margin. And so the language is so focused on financials that it confuses entrepreneurs that that's what really matters. But the reality is, there's something that is driving those numbers that you have to uncover. That's what I always call the strategic value. So number one, you know, what is that strategic value? Why do people choose your business versus your competitors? There's a reason. We got to uncover that. And then finding those companies in the market or in the world that value that, that's kind of the secret, right? It's not about, because nobody really wants to buy revenue or EBITDA. They want to buy the product or service that you have. That's the real driver. And so understanding that dynamic is where a lot of people make mistakes. And what I'm kind of beating the drum on is to say, like, we have to really get down to that strategic value. And the other thing you said, which is worth its weight in gold, is when you uncover that, let's say you do have a $10 million revenue business and you're doing $1 million or $2 million in EBITDA, all that's great. That's a really good business, but you've got this product that someone wants. Well, when I talk about buyer's math, what I mean is your math is, you know, 10 million in revenue, $1 million in EBITDA, and you've got this product. Their math is, what does that product look like when they own it? When they have, instead of your two salespeople, they have 27 salespeople. Instead of your customer list of 1,000 customers, they have 1 million customers. And so all of a sudden, you look at it and say, it's not what it represents in my hands. What's it worth to a buyer? That number tends to be exponentially larger. So the leverage in terms of how you negotiate, how you think about value, changes pretty dramatically. So it's important to, even though, you know, looking at your business, of course, is important, but when you start talking to strategic acquirers, it's really, what does this represent in their hands? And that's what, you know, buyer's math is.
And I love the buyer's math. And I think that was like a real light bulb moment for me. Where in the journey did you learn that logic? And was there something challenging that happened before that that caused you to learn it?
So yeah, there was a specific, you know, moment or experience. I feel like there's one or two things I've done reasonably well in my career. There's, again, a million mistakes. But one of the things that I was pretty good at is identifying alignment and needs. And so when I start talking to strategic partners or investors or anybody, I could typically find, like, what's the thing they're really searching for that I might be able to solve for them. So I was usually pretty good at that. But this buyer math idea really came in because one of my companies, fifth business technically, we were building this incredible technology, and we had, I think then, and I would still argue today, probably the best technical solution in the market. However, we had a lot of very well-funded and much larger competitors that were creating noise in the market. And so it was very difficult for us as a startup with just a little bit of funding to compete with multi-billion dollar organizations. And as I started talking to investors, because we had a decision to make, we either need to raise a lot of money and compete with these big firms, or we need to sell the business to one of them. And so as we got out into the market and started talking to prospective buyers, I kept seeing, you know, that the things that I had, which I had, you know, two engineers and one salesperson, and so I was very constrained in terms of resources. But I kept imagining, if, you know, this company bought us, they have 50 engineers. Like, the product pipeline goes exponential the next day because they can move so fast. Or in many cases, I had relationships. One of the things that was so valuable for me is I tend to find these exclusive distribution partnerships where I can take my product to market. And in this business, I had signed two, one of which gave me access to this incredible exclusive distribution, but I didn't even have the money to market to those people. And I kept looking at the buyer and saying, the second the deal closes, that problem goes away. You have all of the money in the world. You have all of the, you just take this asset that I'm going to give you and you just, you know, turn it into money. And so I could see the math because I kept pulling away the blinders of my own constraints. I have no money. I have no engineers. I have no salespeople, but they don't have that problem. And as soon as I pull those sort of blinders away, I go, wow, this is worth millions and millions to them, even though I can't quite get it turning yet because I don't have the resources. So that was kind of a light bulb moment for me when I realized it's really about, what is this product or service worth to a buyer, not where is it today?
Yeah, this is so powerful. And is that something that you would present to these buyers and these partners as you were getting to know them, just over and over, just repeating that message? Like, don't worry about these numbers, selling the big vision. That was something that you would constantly socialize with them.
100%. I mean, I think it is such a powerful dynamic when, most companies, if you've done a good job of getting to know them or creating some sort of alignment, they're going to be interested. But even for them, sometimes they're not even thinking about it. They're looking at your constraints because they're doing diligence on your business and saying, oh, it's a small company and you're only doing $1 million in EBITDA and you only have three engineers. And you have to kind of remind them repeatedly that, no, that goes away. You know, it's your balance sheet has $200 million in cash on it. Forget what my balance sheet looks like. You have all the resources to make this the best product in the industry. You have all the salespeople we need. So I keep sort of shifting people into this future state as if the deal is already done, imagine what's possible. And people tend to do that. And the other thing I would mention, and you've probably heard me say this, you know, a buyer's ego is also pretty funny. You know, I become very self-deprecating when I'm talking to people. And I would say, I've only been able to grow it to $1 million. You're obviously smarter. You have a much more success than I do. You have more engineers. Imagine what you're going to be able to do. And in the back of their mind, they're going, Max, right? You know, we're a lot smarter. You know, we're gonna do a lot better than he did. Good.
Yeah. Good. Let's do it. Yeah. I love that. That's great. And can you talk just a little bit around the exit of Kick to NBC Sports and how that came about? I think that's a hugely exciting story. And if you could share any of the insights from that.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, so I had this business called Kick, and it was, again, maybe my second kind of effort at combining my passion for soccer with my love of technology and innovation. And it really came through a personal experience. My oldest daughter at the time was playing youth soccer, and I was going to these soccer tournaments, and it felt like I was in a time warp. You know, it's like I can fly on a plane using a boarding pass on my phone, but I go to a soccer tournament and they're getting out these like 3-ring binders and this very old technology. And I said, you know, I can fix that. So Kick basically set out to kind of technologically innovate in youth soccer, primarily in the United States. And so that's what we started building. That was the company I was really just referring to in terms of, we had amazing technology. I really believe we had the best offering in the industry, but we had a few competitors that had raised, one company raised $50 million in venture capital. We had a few million dollars in friends and family. You know, NBC and all the big media companies were trying to come down into youth sports. And so all of a sudden the landscape was incredibly competitive, and almost everyone else was better positioned than we were. Even though we had great technology and I think great, you know, execution, we just had all these resource constraints. And so ultimately we went out to the market. That particular exit was, you know, I think really validating for a few of the things we've already talked about. One, the CEO of the division that acquired us, I had met 2 years prior to going to market. And it was exactly what you said. He was a pretty high profile, successful individual. I reached out to him absolutely cold and just said, hey, I have a lot of respect for you and what you're building. I'm going to be in your town. I'd love to swing by and have a cup of coffee just to say hello. And so I got to know him on a personal level. One really tangential thing that I thought was incredibly cool is that when I physically walked into his office, I actually saw a jacket from the company that I sold a few years earlier, the brand that I sold, Built and Sold. And I was like, oh, you know, Mountain Khakis? And he was like, oh, I love it. You know, they sponsor our local hockey league. I was like, oh, I founded that company.
No way.
So there was this, like, you know, really instant kind of friendship. And I did have a lot of respect for him and the business. But fast forward 2 years later, when we're really trying to decide what is our path forward, we had a few people interested in buying Kick or investing in Kick. And I picked up the phone and just called him and said, you know, we've become friends. I know what our company would look like within NBC Sport. I know that we would be the biggest player the next day. You have the resources, you have all the things that we've been constrained by, and these exclusive deals I've been working on, you can enable them right away. I haven't even been able to get to them yet. So within about 24 hours, they went from that call to starting due diligence and ultimately became the right buyer of our business. But I think without that early connection, they would not even have been on the radar. They wouldn't have been on the list. We wouldn't have known what they were interested in. We wouldn't have known what problem that we could have solved for them. And I'm positive we could have never navigated to the CEO, you know, trying to go through their normal channels. It would have been impossible. So that really validated and kind of finalized for me that all of these things that you need to be doing or can be doing proactively, they compound into value over time. It's little simple things you do if you're 2 or 3 years away from exit. But if you need to sell your business in 6 months, you don't have time to do all those things. You can't really do it. It becomes a scramble. So I'm such a big believer in making these proactive steps. And in that case, it paid, you know, really big dividends for us.
Yeah, definitely. And I think playing that long game, there's just no bad time spent on relationship building. It's just so valuable. Exactly. Amazing. So let's segue just a little bit into sports, because I know you're such a big sports guy for yourself and the kids. And how do you think, like, out with the business side of things, that sports has helped you from a leadership point of view, from a team point of view, like from a performance, like how does that kind of weave into your business career?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I think point, which is, you know, for me, I went from playing soccer. And as I said, all my goals and dreams were, you know, I went from literally playing soccer as for a living. I played briefly professionally to being an entrepreneur kind of, you know, one day to the next very quickly with no real business training or background. So I had to rely a lot on the experiences that I learned, good and bad, through soccer. You know, one of those was just discipline and drive. I think people that achieve a reasonably high level in sports, it's really rare that they don't have a level of discipline and drive. It's hard to just be naturally talented and never work hard and never commit to, you know, so there's a real high correlation between athletic achievement and kind of business achievement. So what that led to, one is my very first business partners were also athletes. My first hires tended to be former athletes because that was one signal to me. If you played sports at a high level, I think you're committed. I think you're disciplined. I think you work hard. I think you understand those things. And so it was one of the few signals that I could get early in my career before I knew how to interview and hire and manage people well. I was relying on sports as kind of the model or the metaphor, I guess, for that. And then the other thing, which was interesting, is I had a longtime business partner that we co-founded businesses together. We had a really like perfect working relationship, but our leadership styles were very, very different. And we met playing sports, playing soccer together. And you could see it all the way back to the beginning when we literally first started playing sports. He was the team captain. He was 2 years older than me. He was the team captain that was leading by example and discipline. And he was just, you know, he was kind of the captain, which to me translates to a great manager, you know, a great leader, because he, you know, was going to manage the team and, you know, tell people what they need to do. I was kind of the, you know, I scored the goals. I was a little, you know, flashier. I wasn't quite as good at, you know, I sort of led by enthusiasm. Let's score, let's win. I never thought about how to like train other people or get the most out of others. I was just like, let me just lead by example. And so when you find those analogies, that's again what I carried into my business career. I realized that I don't think I'm a great manager. I think I am a great leader, only in that I can see a vision, I can get people super inspired and excited to pursue it. But I need to turn around and find who's that manager that can take the vision that I've got and help lead the team in terms of the day-to-day operations and the finance. That's not my strength. So again, all those things very much, you know, related to soccer. That's the way great teams are built. That's the way great businesses are built. So I found a lot of correlations that I still rely on, you know, to this day, that I originally learned on the field.
Yeah. And some of it becomes apparent later in life and you kind of can trace it all the way back. But yeah, I think that's fascinating. And it leads me to ask you about your kids play sports. And I hear a lot from parents of like, how do you build resilience and how do you build gritty kids? And I feel like sports has a large part to play in that. Can you talk to that a little bit from a parenting standpoint and what you've seen with your kids?
Yeah, so my two daughters, they're actually no longer really kids. You know, they're 23 and 20, so they're, you know, young women. But sports for my wife and I were really, really important to kind of be a part of their lives really early on. And I think it was a commitment. You know, it was, you're part of a team. You need to show up for practice. You need to make decisions that are not just about you personally, but about your team. There was some really important kind of learning, I think, associated with that. I had some funny moments, you know, with my younger daughter in particular. We started her playing soccer really, really young, and she wasn't ready. And so she would, you know, kind of sit out sometimes, and I was the team coach. And so at the end of the first season, I think a lot of parents loved me as a coach and probably thought I was the worst dad in history, because I would not give my own daughter a trophy at the end of the season. But it was because it was so important to me to signal, like, you get a trophy because you play and you contribute to the team. You chose to sit out. That's your choice. Why would you get a trophy? You know, and it was a funny like moment that we laugh about in hindsight, but it really was important. I think particularly in today's society, again, I probably make people angry by even saying that, but you know, I played through college. I was a collegiate All-American. I played professionally and I probably have 4 trophies for my entire life. My daughters, by the time they were 8, both had 4 trophies. It's like, maybe we need to like, you know, change the messaging a little bit. So that was important to us. We wanted them to feel that commitment, but we ultimately let both girls decide, did they play? What sport did they play? When did they stop? When did they want to compete at a high level versus drop down? And so we sort of, they had their own journey. Both girls ultimately stopped playing soccer somewhere around probably 13, 14. My older daughter shifted all that into academics. She's a brilliant young lady. And then my younger daughter, you know, shifted into gymnastics and dance and lots of other things that she experimented and ultimately pursued dance at a pretty high level. But to me, sports is really valuable for socialization, learning discipline, and fun, enjoying, you know, life, that it's, there's something out there that you can do that gives you a lot of, you know, energy and passion.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that resilience comes from doing these hard things, and it doesn't always go your way, but that's just part of life. I think sports teaches you so much about that. And something else I've heard you talk about, which is really refreshing, I think, when, you know, people are like, everyone needs to work hard. When you're an entrepreneur, you have to work hard. That's an absolute given. But I hear a lot how you and your wife prioritized family life and the time that you'd spend with your girls when they were growing up. When did you realize that? Was that something you set out, or is that something you learned after you've kind of gone around the ringer a couple of times with, you know, growing and exiting a business is no mean feat. So yeah, just I'm interested in the family side.
I'm really glad you asked that question. I would be disappointed in myself if I would not have somehow brought this up. And it's actually, I think, probably the most important thing that we've talked about. And it's because there basically were almost 2 versions of Mac as an entrepreneur. And version one was, you know, those first 2 companies that we talked about, I was young, I was newly married. I was, you know, first engaged and then married during this process to my now wife. And during that time, I was, you know, kind of a stereotypical workaholic entrepreneur. I worked 80, you know, plus hour weeks. I sometimes would fall asleep on the floor in the office. I mean, it was literally just grinding. In July of 2000, I sold that second company. My first daughter was due to be born in August of 2000, so 30 days away. That month of my life probably is the only time that I can look back and say I was probably clinically depressed. And I was clinically depressed because all the people around me, I was sitting on top of the world as an entrepreneur. I felt like I had, you know, achieved all this early success and I really loved it. I was passionate about it. But all these people around me kept saying, Mac, you keep talking about your daughter who you're really excited about and you want to coach her soccer team and be home every night for dinner. You work 7 days a week. How would you possibly do that? And I was really conflicted in my head. How do I choose? How do I give up on either one? Like, it's impossible for me to imagine not being the type of dad I wanted to be. But I also wasn't really ready at 28 years old to be like, I'm just not going to be a successful entrepreneur at that scale anymore. So I had to make a really interesting decision. And about a week before she was born, I kind of came to that conclusion that despite what everybody was telling me around me, lots of smart people, that I was going to have to pick, I just decided that I was not going to accept the trade-off that everybody was telling me I had to make. And I kind of committed to this unborn little girl that I was going to be there for everything. I didn't know how. I didn't know how I was going to do both, but I was going to do it. The reason it's so relevant is because, you know, she was born in August of 2000. 19 years later, literally August of 2019, I dropped that little girl off for her freshman year of college. And during that period, I was home every night, almost every night, 5 o'clock for dinner. I carved the pumpkins in class. I went to the recitals. I coached the soccer teams. I was there for pretty much everything. But I also built and sold 4 more companies. And so I know that I lived a 19-year proof positive experiment of like, you can do both. And it's not because I had so much money that I didn't have to work. I was grinding and building businesses, but I was committed and prioritizing to my family. And so ultimately, it's important because one, I lived it. I know it's possible. But I also realized that I built my better businesses that way. When I would leave the office at 4:45 to be home for dinner at 5, my businesses actually got better. So I'm glad you asked that question because it was such a key pivotal moment in my life. Probably the most important decision I ever made is sort of that commitment. And so, yeah, that one's really important to me.
Yeah. It's so refreshing to hear it just laid out like that. And I completely get it. And Craig and I own the business together. We leave the office at 4:30 to have dinner with the kids. But then as soon as they go to bed, I start again and I do, okay, all the stuff that didn't get done. Yeah. And I think it's being really disciplined on what are your priorities, and you're going to be home for dinner and you're going to be there for breakfast and take holidays. But having the discipline to pick up on all the other bits when you've got the time to do that. So I think you have to make some kind of weird and wonderful sacrifices sometimes, but that is how you manage to do family plus business. And I think when you become a parent, you are highly effective with your time. So I can do a lot more in a shorter space of time than probably pre-kids, because that's the time you've got. So you just get it done.
Well, and it's, I would say you, my view is you're still the outlier. I mean, I think it's what's tragic is there are a lot of people that will listen to this that will be able to not be able to look in the mirror and say they have figured out a way to find that, you know, whatever you want to call it, the prioritization, the balance, the efficiency. And I just to my core know it is there. And one of the things you can do is exactly what you said. You know, I often jokingly say, you know, I still work 7 days a week, but I also vacation 7 days a week. Like every day is the same for me, you know. Right after this podcast, my wife and I will go have lunch. I have one more call at some point today, and like that's my day. But I also do the same thing on Sundays. I generally have a call. I generally do some work. And so, you know, for me, just like you with your kids, when the kids go to bed, maybe you end up working after they go to bed for another 3 or 4 hours, because the 3 or 4 hours that you spent with them between getting home and them going to bed is incredibly precious. And what I know during those same 19 years that I was just discussing, I can't tell you the tragedy of how many of my friends are plus or minus my age. And they look back over those 19 years and they've made a ton of money and they've been successful, but they missed it. Yeah. They missed it. Their kids are going to college or just graduated college and the time's gone. And so I just can't stress enough that if you're making those trade-offs, if you're sacrificing in a way that you think, oh, once I get to this next level, I'll be able to spend time with the kids, like that day never comes. Like you have to change.
I think I realized that a while ago. So after, we started the business quite young as well. And I always thought, okay, when we get to this point, when we get, you know, this client or this amount of revenue or this problem is solved, and I realized it's never solved. It never goes away. So you just have to kind of park it, do, you know, prioritize time with the family, and then it's always there to pick up. So yeah, I think it's you get used to all of the different weird and wonderful things, but like you say, you've got huge amounts of flexibility but huge amounts of responsibility. So you maybe don't go on a vacation in the same way that, you know, you maybe did previously. There's always something to be done, but yeah, I think the rewards are huge, you know, to be able to manage both. So
and important. Yeah,
very lucky. Okay, so I'm running out of time. So I think probably two last things I want to ask you about. So you have a fantastic mentoring program through Exit DNA, and I think really helps entrepreneurs and founders realize the value of the assets that they've built. What is the one thing that you probably find yourself repeating to entrepreneurs over and over again who are scaling businesses, exiting, starting? What's the thing, maybe thing comes up the most?
I think, you know, I think we've touched on so many of the you know, things that are often missed, but what it really comes down to is shifting from, you know, reactive or waiting to proactive. Like if you are thinking you might want to sell your business one day in the future, you don't know if you're like, you have to start pretty much now building in. That's why I call my program Exit DNA. You have to weave this idea of I want the option to exit into the DNA of my business. The way we make decisions, the way we build things, the way we schedule holidays, vacation, all of those things have to become intentional. And when you do that, it compounds into value over time. No matter what your timeline is, the earlier you start, just like compounding interest in the stock market, the more it compounds. And I always consider it such a tragedy that people think they'll get to it next year. They don't know when they want to sell. And then inevitably something changes. You know, somebody gets sick, somebody retires, the COVID happens, you know, some external factor, and you haven't done these things that really put you in a position to be opportunistic. And so I would say that's the thing that I constantly have to stress is people say, oh, I'd love to do exit DNA, but I'm probably not going to exit for a few years. So I'll wait. I'm like, just going to cost you money and maybe life-changing opportunity. I understand it. Everybody's busy, but waiting is the problem.
That's really helpful. And I heard you say something else, which I never heard anyone else say before. I think it was important because we get approached by different people and brokers and investors and all of that stuff to sell businesses. And you said you were sitting in a room and kind of listening to some of these advisors try and sell your business. And you're like, yeah, it's that, but it's not quite that. And really, you are the best person to sell your business because you've lived and breathed it for decades. And I'd never heard anyone else say that. I don't know if you want to expand on that slightly because I thought it was so interesting.
Well, I think it's probably relatively common or typical. You know, I found myself as a young entrepreneur where I suddenly had this point where I wanted to sell a business. I looked at the investment bankers for, you know, they're incredibly smart, well-pedigreed, experienced, all the things that I didn't feel like I was. Like, okay, of course they should be the ones that help me sell the business. That's what they do. And as you mentioned, you know, I found myself sitting in the room, kind of in the back of the room, when they're taking the lead on talking to prospective buyers and talking to people that might really represent the future of the legacy that we've created. And as they were answering questions, they were saying, you know, one thing after another that I kept in my mind going, gosh, I would have never answered it that way. That's not really quite the way I would have responded, or that doesn't feel, even worse, like aligned with my morals and ethics. Like, I think they're kind of misrepresenting here. And so I really got uncomfortable, ultimately fired the bankers and ended up doing it ourselves. But it ultimately comes down to the point you said, like, I'm not anti-investment banker by any means. I think it's really smart. Most companies probably should find an M&A advisor or investment banker ultimately. Once they understand the process, and they also cannot take themselves out, you are the expert. You know your market, you know your culture, you know your industry, and no one will ever be as good as you at telling that story and answering those questions. So you have to continue to play a role. Even if you really bring on the full team of M&A folks, don't outsource your exit is the way I say it. Like, you have to maintain a role in that process.
Yeah, it makes so much sense because I think you've spent years selling your business to clients, to employees, to partners, to vendors. And then all of a sudden you go, oh, we're just going to give it to all these guys because, you know, I've got these professional qualifications that maybe I don't. So, yeah, I think that was really helpful and probably helps people overcome maybe that imposter syndrome just because it's something new. So you've been extremely generous and shared a ton of advice and insights with us today. Going back, is there any advice you got really early on in your career that you still hold today and you still think about and still comes up for you? I'm always interested in that.
I would say the biggest thing that's been consistent from day one, you know, till this morning, is at the end of the day, it's almost always people. You know, finding the right partners, mentors, advisors, you know, I just think that is where the real difference in life is. And so for me, you know, a lot of what I, when I talk to entrepreneurs about what I try to do with mentoring and exit DNA is, you know, find those critical success factors in your business, the things that you think you're going to need to do really well, and find someone that's already done it more than once, because they're the people that know how to teach you. It's just not worth it trying to figure it out on your own. It's not worth it, you know, for you to, just because you're smart and driven, you don't need to do all these things. Hire people that are experts, find advisors that are experts, partner people with it, that are experts. Like that, I look back over everything I've done and I can always point to another person that ultimately was like, because I partnered with that person or got that mentor, that was the key to what ultimately became a successful outcome. So to me, like really, I have to maintain my focus on, I need to surround myself with those people at all times.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing and for joining us today. You are an incredible guest and we have so much to learn from you. So thank you for your time. Thank you for listening to this episode of Tag Lab. We are super excited to bring you the huge conversations that inspire growth in our digital world. Make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button to be notified as soon as the next episode is out. Thanks for listening.